Stranger in a Strange Land by Robert A. Heinlein continued. Cassette 4, Side 2. Mike had seen a weather forecast and had assumed that this was a message from human old ones for those still corporate. He held a similar assumption concerning the authors of the Encyclopedia Britannica. But last, and worst, to Jubal, Mike had grokked the Fosterite service as announcing impending discorporation of two humans to join the human old ones. And Mike was tremendously excited. Had he grokked it rightly? Mike knew that his English was imperfect. He made mistakes through ignorance, being only an egg. But had he grokked this correctly? He had been waiting to meet the human old ones. He had many questions to ask. Was this an opportunity? Or did he require more learnings before he was ready? Jubal was saved by the bell. Dorcas arrived with sandwiches and coffee. Jubal ate silently, which suited Smith, as his rearing had taught him that eating was a time of meditation. Jubal stretched his meal while he pondered, and cursed himself for letting Mike watch stereo. Oh, the boy had to come up against religions. Couldn't be helped if he was going to spend his life on this dizzy planet, but damn it, it would have been better to wait until Mike was used to the cockeyed pattern of human behavior. And not Fosterites as his first experience. A devout agnostic, Jubal rated all religions, from the animism of Kalahari Bushmen to the most intellectualized faith, as equal. But emotionally, he disliked some more than others, and the Church of the New Revelation set his teeth on edge. The Fosterites' flat-footed claim to Gnosis through a direct line to heaven, their arrogant intolerance, their football rally and sales convention services, these depressed him. If people must go to church, why the devil couldn't they be dignified, like Catholics, Christian Scientists, or Quakers? If God existed, concerning which Jubal maintained neutrality, and if he wanted to be worshipped, a proposition which Jubal found improbable, but nevertheless possible in the light of his own ignorance, then it seemed wildly unlikely that a god potent to shape galaxies would be swayed by the whoop-de-doo nonsense the Fosterites offered as worship. But with bleak honesty, Jubal admitted that the Fosterites might own the truth, the exact truth, nothing but the truth. The universe was a silly place at best, but the least likely explanation for it was the no explanation of random chance. The conceit that abstract somethings just happened to be atoms that just happened to get together in ways which just happened to look like consistent laws, and some configurations just happened to possess self-awareness, and that, too, just happened to be the man from Mars and a bald-headed old coot with Jubal inside. No, he could not swallow the just-happened theory, popular as it was with men who called themselves scientists. Random chance was not a sufficient explanation of the universe. Random chance was not sufficient to explain random chance. The pot could not hold itself. What, then? Least hypothesis deserved no preference. Occam's razor could not slice the prime problem, the nature of the mind of God. Might as well call it that, you old scoundrel. It's an Anglo-Saxon monosyllable not banned by four letters, and as good a tag for what you don't understand as any. Was there any basis for preferring any sufficient hypothesis over another? When you did not understand a thing? No. Jubal admitted that a long life had left him not understanding the basic problems of the universe. The Fosterites might be right. But, he reminded himself savagely, two things remained, his taste and his pride. If the Fosterites held a monopoly on truth, if heaven were open only to Fosterites, then he, Jubal Harshaw, gentleman, preferred that eternity of pain-filled damnation promised to sinners who refuse the new revelation. He could not see the naked face of God, but his eyesight was good enough to pick out his social equals, and those Fosterites did not measure up. But he could see how Mike had been misled. The Fosterite going to heaven at a selected time did sound like the voluntary discorporation, which Jubal did not doubt was the practice on Mars. Jubal suspected that a better term for the Fosterite practice was murder, but such had never been proved and rarely hinted. Foster had been the first to go to heaven on schedule, dying at a prophesied instant. Since then, it had been a Fosterite mark of special grace. It had been years since any coroner had had the temerity to pry into such deaths. Not that Jubal cared. A good Fosterite was a dead Fosterite. But it was going to be hard to explain. No use stalling. Another cup of coffee wouldn't make it easier. Mike, who made the world?
Beg pardon?
Look around you. All this. Mars, too, the stars. Everything. You and me and everybody. Did the old ones tell you who made it?
Mike looked puzzled. No, Jubal.
Well, have you wondered? Where did the sun come from? Who put the stars in the sky? Who started it? All. Everything. The whole world. The universe. So that you and I are here talking.
Jubal paused, surprised at himself. He had intended to take the usual agnostic approach, and found himself compulsively following his legal training, being an honest advocate in spite of himself, attempting to support a religious belief he did not hold, but which was believed by most human beings. He found that willy-nilly he was attorney for the orthodoxies of his own race against, he wasn't sure what, an unhuman viewpoint.
How do your old ones answer such questions?
Jubal, I do not grok that these are questions. I am sorry.
Eh? I don't grok your answer.
Mike hesitated. I will try, but words are not rightly. Not putting, not mating, a nowing. World is, world was, world shall be, now.
As it was in the beginning, so it is now and ever shall be, world without end.
Mike smiled happily. You grok it.
I don't grok it, Jubal answered gruffly. I'm quoting something an old one said.
He decided to try another approach. God the Creator was not the aspect of deity to use as an opening. Mike did not grasp the idea of creation. Well, Jubal wasn't sure that he did either. Long ago he had made a pact with himself to postulate a created universe on even-numbered days, a tale-swallowing eternal and uncreated universe on odd-numbered days, since each hypothesis, whole paradoxical, avoided the paradoxes of the other, with a day off each leap year for sheer solipsist debauchery. Having tabled an unanswerable question, he had given no thought to it for more than a generation. Jubal decided to explain religion in its broadest sense, and tackle the notion of deity and its aspects later. Mike agreed that learnings came in various sizes, from little learnings that a nestling could grok, on up to great learnings which only an old one could grok in fullness. But Jubal's attempt to draw a line between small learnings and great, so that great learnings would have the meanings of religious questions, was not successful. Some religious questions did not seem to Mike to be questions, such as creation, and others seemed to him to be little questions, with answers obvious to nestlings, such as life after death. Jubal dropped it and passed on to the multiplicity of human religions. He explained that humans had hundreds of ways by which great learnings were taught, each with its own answers and each claiming to be the truth.
What is truth? Mike asked.
What is truth? Asked a Roman judge and washed his hands. Jubal wished that he could do likewise.
An answer is truth when you speak rightly, Mike. How many hands do I have?
Two hands. I see two hands, Mike amended. Anne glanced up from reading. In 6 weeks I can make a witness of him.
Quiet, Anne. Things are tough enough. Mike, you spoke rightly. I have two hands. Your answer is truth. Suppose you said that I had seven hands.
Mike looked troubled.
I do not grok that I could say that.
No, I don't think you could. You would not speak rightly. If you did, your answer would not be truth. But, Mike, listen carefully. Each religion claims to be truth, claims to speak rightly, yet their answers are as different as two hands and seven hands. Fosterites say one thing, Buddhists say another, Muslims still another. Many answers, all different.
Mike seemed to be making great effort.
All speak rightly? Jubal, I do not grok.
Nor I.
The man from Mars looked troubled, then suddenly smiled.
I will ask the Fosterites to ask your old ones, and then we will know, my brother. How will I do this?
A few minutes later, Jubal found, to his disgust, that he had promised Mike an interview with some Fosterite big mouth. nor had he been able to dent Mike's assumption that Fosterites were in touch with human old ones. Mike's difficulty was that he didn't know what a lie was. Definitions of lie and falsehood had been filed in his mind with no trace of grokking. One could speak wrongly only by accident. So he had taken the Fosterite service at its face value. Jubal tried to explain that all human religions claim to be in touch with old ones one way or another. Nevertheless, their answers were all different. Mike looked patiently troubled.
Jubal, my brother, I try. But I do not grok how this can be right speaking. With my people, old ones speak always rightly. Your people?
Hold it, Mike.
Beg pardon?
When you said my people, you were talking about Martians. Mike, you are not a Martian. You are a man.
What is man?
Jubal groaned. Mike could, he was sure, quote the dictionary definitions, yet the lad never asked a question to be annoying. He asked always for information, and expected Jubal to be able to tell him.
I am a man. You are a man. Larry is a man.
But Anne is not a man?
Anne is a man, a female man, a woman.
Thanks, Jubal.
Shut up, Anne.
A baby is a man? I have seen pictures, and in the goddamn noise... in stereovision. A baby is not shaped like Anne, and Anne is not shaped like you, and you are not shaped like I. But a baby is a nestling man?
Yes, a baby is a man.
Jubal, I think I grok that my people, Martians, are man. Not shape. Shape is not man. Man is grokking. I speak rightly?
Jubal decided to resign from the Philosophical Society and take up tatting. What was grokking? He had been using the word for a week, and he didn't grok it. But what was man? A featherless biped, God's image, or a fortuitous result of survival of the fittest in a circular definition? The heir of death and taxes? The Martians seemed to have defeated death, and they seemed not to have money, property, nor government in any human sense, so how could they have taxes? Yet the boy was right. Shape was irrelevant in defining man, as unimportant as the bottle containing the wine. You could even take a man out of his bottle, like that poor fellow whose life those Russians had saved by placing his brain in a vitreous envelope and wiring him like a telephone exchange. Gad, what a horrible joke! He wondered if the poor devil appreciated the humor. But how, from the viewpoint of a Martian, did man differ from other animals? Would a race that could levitate, and God knows what else, be impressed by engineering? If so, would the Aswan Dam or 1,000 miles of coral reef win first prize? Man's self-awareness? Sheer conceit. There was no way to prove that sperm whales or sequoias were not philosophers and poets exceeding any human merit. There was one field in which man was unsurpassed. He showed unlimited ingenuity in devising bigger and more efficient ways to kill off, enslave, harass, and in all ways make an unbearable nuisance of himself to himself. Man was his own grimmest joke on himself. The very bedrock of humor was...
Man is the animal who laughs, Jubal answered.
Mike considered this.
Then I am not a man.
Huh?
I do not laugh. I have heard laughing, and it frighted me. Then I grokked that it did not hurt. I have tried to learn.
Mike threw his head back and gave out a raucous cackle. Jubal covered his ears.
Stop!
You heard, Mike agreed sadly. I cannot rightly do it, so I am not a man.
Wait a minute, son, you simply haven't learned yet, and you'll never learn by trying. But you will, I promise you. If you live among us long enough, one day you will see how funny we are, and you will laugh.
I will?
You will. Don't worry, just let it come. Why, son, even a Martian would laugh once he grokked us.
I will wait, Smith agreed placidly.
And while you are waiting, don't doubt that you are man. You are. Man born of woman and born to trouble. And someday you will grok its fullness and laugh, because man is the animal that laughs at himself. About your Martian friends, I do not know. But I grok that they may be man.
Yes, Jubal.
Harshaw thought that the interview was over and felt relieved. He had not been so embarrassed since a day long ago when his father had explained the birds and the bees and the flowers. Much too late. But the man from Mars was not yet done. "Jubal, my brother, you were asking me, who made the world? And I did not have words why I did not grok it rightly to be a question. I have been thinking words."
"So?"
"You told me, God made the world."
"No, no," Harshaw said. "I told you that while religion said many things, most of them said God made the world. I told you that I did not grok the fullness, but that God was the word that was used."
"Yes, Jubal," Mike agreed. "Word is God." He added, "You grok."
"I must admit I don't grok."
"You grok," Smith repeated firmly. "I am explain. I did not have the word. You grok, Anne groks, I grok. The grasses under my feet grok in happy beauty, but I needed the word. The word is God."
"Go ahead."
Mike pointed triumphantly at Jubal.
"Thou art God."
Jubal slapped a hand to his face.
"Oh, Jesus H., what have I done? Look, Mike, take it easy. You didn't understand me. I'm sorry. I'm very sorry. Just forget what I've said and we'll start over another day."
"But thou art God," Mike repeated serenely. "That which groks. Anne is God. I am God. The happy grasses are God. Jill groks in beauty always. Jill is God. All shaping and making and creating together." He croaked something in Martian and smiled.
"All right, Mike. But let it wait. Anne, have you been getting this?"
"You bet I have, boss."
"Make a tape. I'll have to work on it. I can't let it stand. I must..."
Jubal glanced up, said,
"Oh, my God. General quarters, everybody. Anne, set the panic button on dead man, and for God's sake, keep your thumb on it. They may not be coming here."
He glanced up again, at two air cars approaching from the south.
"I'm afraid they are. Mike, hide in the pool. Remember what I told you. Down in the deepest part, stay there, hold still. Don't come up until I send Jill."
"Yes, Jubal."
"Right now, move."
"Yes, Jubal." Mike ran the few steps, cut water, and disappeared. He kept his knees straight, toes pointed, feet together.
"Jill,"
Jubal called out,
"dive in and climb out. You too, Larry. If anybody saw that, I want them confused as to how many are using the pool. Dorcas, climb out fast, child, and dive in again. And, no, you've got the panic button."
"I can take my cloak and go to the edge of the pool. Boss, do you want a delay on this dead man setting?"
30 seconds. If they land, put on your witness cloak and get your thumb back on the button. Then wait. And if I call you to me, let the balloon go up. I don't dare shout wolf unless..."
He shielded his eyes.
"One of them is going to land, and it's got that paddy wagon look. Oh, damn, I thought they would parley."
The first car hovered, dropped for a landing in the garden around the pool. The second started circling at low altitude. The cars were squad carriers in size and showed a small insignia, the stylized globe of the Federation. Anne put down the radio relay link, got quickly into professional garb, picked up the link, and put her thumb on the button. The door of the first car opened as it touched, and Jubal charged toward it with the belligerence of a Pekingese. As a man stepped out, Jubal roared,
"Get that goddamn heap off my rose bushes!"
The man said, "Jubal Harshaw,
tell that oaf to raise that bucket and move it back. Off the garden and onto the grass. Anne?"
"Coming, boss."
"Jubal Harshaw, I have a warrant for..." "I don't care if you've got a warrant for the King of England. Move that junk off my flowers, then, so help me, I'll sue you for..."
Jubal glanced at the man, appeared to see him for the first time.
"Oh, so it's you,"
he said with bitter contempt.
"Were you born, stupid Heinrich, or did you have to study? When did that uniformed jackass learn to fly?"
"Please examine this warrant," Captain Heinrich said with careful patience.
"Then get your go-card out of my flower beds or I'll make a civil rights case that will cost you your pension."
Heinrich hesitated.
"Now,"
Jubal screamed,
"and tell those yokels getting out to pick up their feet that idiot with the buck teeth is standing on a prize, Elizabeth M. Hewitt."
Heinrich turned his head.
"You men, careful of those flowers. Paskin, you're standing on one. Rogers, raise the car and move back clear of the garden."
He turned to Harshaw.
"Does that satisfy you? Once he moves it, but you'll still pay damages. Let's see your credentials, and show them to the fair witness, and state loud and clear your name, rank, organization, and pay number."
"You know who I am.
I have a warrant to part your hair with a shotgun unless you do things legally and in order. I don't know who you are. You look like a stuffed shirt I saw over the telephone. But I don't identify you. You must identify yourself in specified fashion, World Code Paragraph 1602, Part 2, before you may serve a warrant. And that goes for those other apes, too, and that Pithecan parasite piloting for you.
They are police officers, acting under my orders.
I don't know that they are. They might have hired those ill-fitting clown suits at a costumer's. The letter of the law, sir. You've come barging into my castle. You say you are a police officer, and you allege that you have a warrant for this intrusion, but I say you are trespassers until you prove otherwise, which invokes my sovereign right to use force to eject you, which I shall start to do in about 3 seconds.
I wouldn't advise it.
Why are you to advise? If I'm hurt in attempting to enforce this my right, your action becomes constructive assault with deadly weapons. If the things those mules are toting are guns, as they appear to be, civil and criminal both. Why, my man, I'll have your hide for a doormat.
Jubal drew back a skinny arm and clenched a fist.
Off my property.
Hold it, doctor. We'll do it your way.
Heinrich had turned red, but he kept his voice under tight control. He offered his identification, which Jubal glanced at, then handed back for Heinrich to show to Anne. He then stated his full name, said that he was a captain of police, Federation Special Service Bureau, and recited his pay number. One by one, the other troopers and the driver went through the rigmarole at Heinrich's frozen-faced orders. When they were done, Jubal said sweetly,
"And now, Captain, how may I help you?"
"I have a warrant for Gilbert Berquist, which warrant names this property, its buildings and grounds."
"Show it to me. Then show it to the witness."
"I will do so. I have another warrant similar to the first for Jillian Boardman."
"Who?"
"Jillian Boardman. The charge is kidnapping."
"My goodness."
"And another for Hector C. Johnson, and one for Valentine Michael Smith."
"And one for you, Jubal Harshaw."
"Me?
Taxes again?"
"No, accessory to this and that, and material witness on other things. And I'd take you in on my own for obstructing justice if the warrant didn't make it unnecessary."
"Oh, come, Captain. I've been most cooperative since you identified yourself and started behaving in a legal manner. And I shall continue to be. Of course, I shall still sue you and your immediate superior and the government for your illegal acts before that time, and I'm not waiving any rights or recourses with respect to anything any of you may do hereafter."
"Hmm.
Quite a list of victims. I see why you brought an extra wagon. But, dear me, something odd here. This, Mrs. Bachman, I see that she is charged with kidnapping this Smith fella. But in this other warrant, he seems to be charged with fleeing custody. I'm confused."
"It's both. He escaped, and she kidnapped him."
"Isn't that difficult to manage? Both, I mean. And on what charge was he being held? The warrant does not seem to state."
"How the devil do I know? He escaped, that's all. He's a fugitive."
"Gracious me, I think I shall have to offer my services as counsel to each of them." "Interesting case. If a mistake has been made, or mistakes, it could lead to other matters."
Heinrich grinned coldly. "You won't find it easy. You'll be in the pokey, too."
"Oh, not for long, I trust."
Jubal raised his voice and turned his head toward the house.
"I think, if Judge Holland were listening, habeas corpus proceedings for all of us might be rather prompt. And if the Associated Press happened to have a courier car nearby, there would be no time lost in knowing where to serve such writs."
"Always the shyster, eh, Harshaw?"
"Slander, my dear sir. I take notice.
A fat lot of good it will do you.
We're alone."
"Are we?"
Chapter 15 Valentine Michael Smith swam through murky water to the deepest part, under the diving board, and settled on the bottom. He did not know why his water brother had told him to hide. He did not know he was hiding. Jubal had told him to do this and remain until Jill came for him. That was sufficient. He curled up, let air out of his lungs, swallowed his tongue, rolled his eyes up, slowed his heart, and became effectively dead, save that he was not discorporate. He elected to stretch his time sense until seconds flowed past like hours, as he had much to meditate. He had failed again to achieve the perfect understanding, the mutual merging rapport, the grokking that should exist between water brothers. He knew the failure was his, caused by his using wrongly the oddly variable human language, because Jubal had become upset. He knew that his human brothers could suffer intense emotion without damage. Nevertheless, Smith was wistfully sorry to have caused upset in Jubal. It had seemed that he had at last grokked a most difficult human word. He should have known better, because early in his learnings under his brother Mahmud, he had discovered that long human words rarely changed their meanings. But short words were slippery, changing without pattern. Or so he seemed to grok. Short human words were like trying to lift water with a knife. This had been a very short word. Smith still felt that he grokked rightly the human word, God. Confusion had come from his failure in selecting other words. The concept was so simple, so basic, so necessary, that a nestling could explain it. In Martian, the problem was to find human words that would let him speak rightly, make sure that he patterned them to match in fullness how it would be said in his own people's language. He puzzled over the fact that there should be any difficulty in saying it, even in English, since it was a thing everyone knew, else they could not grok alive. Possibly he should ask the human old ones how to say it, rather than struggle with shifting meanings. If so, he must wait until Jubal arranged it, for he was only an egg. He felt brief regret that he was not privileged to attend discorporation of Brother Art and Brother Dottie. Then he settled down to review Webster's New International Dictionary of the English Language, 3rd edition, published in Springfield, Massachusetts. From a long way off, Smith was roused by uneasy awareness that his water brothers were in trouble. He paused between sherbatcha and sherbet to ponder this. Should he leave the water of life and join them to grok and share their trouble? At home there could have been no question. Trouble is shared in joyful closeness. But Jubal had told him to wait. He reviewed Jubal's words, trying them against other human words, making sure that he grokked. No, he had grokked rightly. He must wait until Jill came. Nevertheless, he was so uneasy that he could not go back to his word hunt. At last an idea came that was filled with such gay daring that he would have trembled had his body been ready. Jubal had told him to place his body underwater and leave it there until Jill came. But had Jubal said that he himself must wait with the body? Smith took a long time to consider this, knowing that slippery English words could lead him into mistakes. He concluded that Jubal had not ordered him to stay with his body, and that left a way out of the wrongness of not sharing his brother's trouble. So Smith decided to take a walk. He was dazed at his own audacity, for while he had done it before, he had never soloed. Always an old one had been with him, watching over him, making sure that his body was safe, keeping him from becoming disoriented, staying with him until he returned to his body. There was no old one to help him now, but Smith was confident that he could do it alone in a fashion that would fill his teacher with pride. So he checked every part of his body, made certain that it would not damage while he was gone, then got cautiously out of it, leaving behind that trifle of himself needed as caretaker. He rose up and stood on the edge of the pool, remembering to behave as if his body were with him as a guard against disorienting, against losing track of pool, body, everything, and wandering off into unknown places where he could not find his way back. Smith looked around. A car was just landing in the garden, and beings under it were complaining of injuries and indignities. Was this the trouble he could feel? Grasses were for walking on. Flowers and bushes were not. This was a wrongness. No, there was more wrongness. A man was stepping out of the car, one foot about to touch the ground, and Jubal was running toward him. Smith could see the anger that Jubal was hurling toward the man, a blast so furious that had one Martian hurled it toward another, both would discorporate. Smith noted it as something to ponder, and if it was a cusp of necessity, decided what he must do to help his brother. Then he looked over the others. Dorcas was climbing out of the pool. She was troubled, but not too much so. Smith could feel her confidence in Jubal. Larry was at the edge and had just gotten out. Drops of water falling from him were in the air. Larry was excited and pleased. His confidence in Jubal was absolute. Miriam was near him. Her mood was midway between those of Dorcas and Larry. Anne was standing nearby, dressed in the long white garment she had had with her all day. Smith could not fully grok her mood. He felt in her the cold, unyielding discipline of an old one. It startled him. as Anne was always soft and gentle and warmly friendly. He saw that she was watching Jubal closely and was ready to help him. And so was Larry. And Dorcas. And Miriam. With a burst of empathy, Smith learned that all these friends were water brothers of Jubal, and therefore of him. This release from blindness shook him so that he almost lost anchorage. Calming himself, he stopped to praise and cherish them all, one by one and together. Jill had one arm over the edge of the pool, and Smith knew that she had been down under, checking on his safety. He had been aware of her when she had done it, but now he knew that she had not, alone, been worried about his safety. Jill felt other and greater trouble, trouble that was not relieved by knowing that her charge was safe under the water of life. This troubled him much, and he considered going to her, making her know that he was with her and sharing her trouble. He would have done so, had it not been for a faint feeling of guilt. He was not certain that Jubal wanted him to walk around while his body was in the pool. He compromised by telling himself that he would share their trouble, and let them know that he was present if it became needful. Smith then looked over the man who was stepping out of the air car, felt his emotions, and recoiled from them, forced himself to examine him carefully inside and out. In a shaped pocket strapped around his waist, the man was carrying a gun. Smith was almost certain it was a gun. He examined it in detail, comparing it with guns he had seen, checking it against the definition in Webster's New International Dictionary of the English Language, 3rd edition, published in Springfield, Massachusetts. Yes, it was a gun, not alone in shape, but also in wrongness that surrounded and penetrated it. Smith looked down the barrel, saw how it must function, and wrongness stared back at him. Should he turn it and let it go elsewhere, taking its wrongness with it? Do it before the man was fully out of the car? Smith felt that he should. And yet Jubal had once told him not to do this to a gun, until Jubal told him that it was time. He knew now that this was indeed a cusp of necessity, but he resolved to balance on the point of the cusp until he grokked all, since it was possible that Jubal, knowing that a cusp was approaching, had sent him underwater to keep him from acting wrongly. He would wait, but he would watch this gun. Not being limited to eyes, being able to see all around if needful, he continued to watch gun and man while he went inside the car. More wrongness than he would have believed possible. Other men were in there, all but one crowding toward the door. Their minds smelled like a pack of cauga who had scented an unwary nymph, and each one held in his hands a something having wrongness. As he had told Jubal, Smith knew that shape was never a prime determinant. It was necessary to go beyond shape, to essence, in order to grok. His own people passed through 5 major shapes, egg, nymph, nestling, adult, and old one, which had no shape, yet the essence of an old one was patterned in the egg. These somethings seemed like guns, but Smith did not assume that they were. He examined one most carefully. It was larger than any gun he had ever seen. Its shape was different. Its details were quite different. It was a gun. He examined each of the others just as carefully. They were guns. The one man still seated had strapped to him a small gun. The car had built into it 2 enormous guns, plus other things which Smith could not grok, but in which he felt wrongness. He considered twisting car, contents, and all, letting it topple away. But in addition to his lifelong inhibition against wasting food, he knew that he did not grok what was happening. Better to move slowly, watch carefully, and help and share at cusp by following Jubal's lead. And if right action was to remain passive, then go back to his body when cusp had passed and discuss it with Jubal later. He went outside the car and watched and listened and waited. The first man to get out talked with Jubal concerning things which Smith could only file without grokking. They were beyond his experience. The other men got out and spread out. Smith spread his attention to watch them all. The car raised, moved backwards, stopped again, which relieved the beings it had sat on. Smith grokked with them, trying to soothe their hurtings. The first man handed papers to Jubal. They were passed to Anne. Smith read them with her. He recognized their word shapings as being concerned with human rituals of healing and balance. But since he had encountered these rituals only in Jubal's law library, he did not try to grok the papers, especially as Jubal seemed untroubled by them. The wrongness was elsewhere. He was delighted to recognize his own human name on two papers. He always got an odd thrill out of reading it, as if he were two places at once, impossible as that was for any but an old one. Jubal and the first man walked toward the pool, with Anne close behind. Smith relaxed his time sense to let them move faster, keeping it stretched just enough so that he could comfortably watch all the men at once. Two men closed in and flanked the group. The first man stopped near Smith's friends by the pool, looked at them, took a picture from his pocket, looked at it, looked at Jill. Smith felt her fear mount, and he became very alert. Jubal had told him, "Protect Jill. Don't worry about wasting food. Don't worry about anything else. Protect Jill." He would protect Jill in any case, even at the risk of acting wrongly. But it was good to have Jubal's reassurance. It left his mind undivided and untroubled. When the man pointed at Jill and the two men flanking him hurried toward her with their guns of great wrongness, Smith reached out through his doppelganger and gave them each that tiny twist which causes to topple away. The first man stared at where they had been and reached for his gun, and he was gone too. The other four started to close in. Smith did not want to twist them. He felt that Jubal would be pleased if he simply stopped them. But stopping a thing, even an ashtray, is work, and Smith did not have his body. An old one could have managed it. But Smith did what he could, what he had to do. Four feather touches. They were gone. He felt intense wrongness from the car on the ground and went to it, grokked a quick decision. Car and pilot were gone. He almost overlooked the car riding cover patrol. Smith started to relax, when suddenly he felt wrongness increase and looked up. The second car was coming in for a landing. Smith stretched time to his limit and went to the car in the air, inspected it carefully, grokked that it was choked with wrongness, tilted it into neverness. Then he returned to the group by the pool. His friend seemed excited. Dorcas was sobbing, and Jill was holding and soothing her. Anne alone seemed untouched by emotions Smith felt seething around him. But wrongness was gone, all of it, and with it the trouble that had disturbed his meditations. Dorcas, he knew, would be healed faster by Jill than by anyone. Jill always grokked a hurting fully and at once. Disturbed by emotions around him, uneasy that he might not have acted in all ways rightly at cusp, or that Jubal might so grok, Smith decided that he was now free to leave. He slipped back into the pool, found his body, grokked that it was as he had left it, slipped it back on. He considered contemplating events at cusp, but they were too new. He was not ready to enfold them, not ready to praise and cherish the men he had been forced to move. Instead, he returned happily to the task he had been on. Sherbet, Sherbetly, Sherbetside. He had reached tin work and was about to consider tiny when he felt Jill approaching. He unswallowed his tongue and made himself ready, knowing that his brother Jill could not remain long underwater without distress. As she touched him, he took her face in his hands and kissed her. It was a thing he had learned quite lately and did not grok perfectly. It had the growing closer of water ceremony, but it had something else, too. Something he wanted to grok in perfect fullness. Chapter 16. Harshaw did not wait for Jillian to dig her problem child out of the pool. He left orders for Dorcas to be given a sedative and hurried to his study, leaving Anne to explain, or not, the events of the last 10 minutes.
"Front!"
he called over his shoulder. Miriam caught up with him. "I must be front," she said breathlessly. "But, boss, what in the—"
"Girl, not one word."
"But, boss—"
"Zip it, I said. Miriam, a week from now we'll sit down and get Anne to tell us what happened, but right now everybody and his cousins will be phoning and reporters will crawl out of trees and I've got to make some calls first. Are you the sort of female who comes unstuck when she's needed? That reminds me, make a note to Doc Dorcas's pay for the time she's been having hysterics."
Miriam gasped.
"Boss, you just dare and every single one of us will quit."
"Nonsense."
"Quit picking on Dorcas. Why, I would have had hysterics myself if she hadn't beaten me to it," she added. "I think I'll have hysterics now."
Harshaw grinned.
"You do, and I'll spank you. All right, put Dorcas down for a bonus for hazardous duty. Put all of you down for a bonus, me especially. I earned it."
"All right. Who pays your bonus?"
"The taxpayers will find a way to clip."
"Damn!" They had reached the study. The telephone was already demanding attention. He slid into the seat and keyed in.
"Harshaw speaking. Who the devil are you?"
Skip it, Doc, a face answered. You haven't frightened me in years. How's everything?
Harshaw recognized Thomas McKenzie, production manager in chief for New World Networks. He mellowed slightly.
Well enough, Tom, but I'm rushed as can be, so...
You're rushed. Try my 48-hour day. Do you still think you're going to have something for us? I don't mind the equipment, I can overhead that, but I have to pay 3 crews just to stand by for your signal. I want to do you any favor I can. We've used lots of your script, and we expect to use more in the future. But I wonder what to tell our controller.
Harshaw stared.
Don't you think that spot coverage was enough?
What spot coverage?
Shortly, Harshaw knew that New World Networks had seen nothing of recent events at his home. He stalled McKenzie's questions because he was certain that truthful answers would convince McKenzie that poor old Harshaw had gone to pieces. Instead, they agreed that if nothing worth picking up happened in 24 hours, New World could remove cameras and equipment. As the screen cleared, Harshaw ordered,
Get Larry. Have him fetch that panic button. Ann has it.
He made 2 more calls. By the time Larry arrived, Harshaw knew that no network had been watching when the special service squads attempted to raid his home. It was not necessary to check on the hold messages. Their delivery depended on the same signal that had failed to reach the networks. Larry offered him the panic button, portable radio link.
You wanted this, boss?
I wanted to sneer at it. Larry, let this be a lesson. Never trust machinery more complicated than a knife and fork.
Okay. Anything else?
Is there a way to check that dingus without hauling 3 networks out of bed?
Sure. The transceiver they set up down in the shop has a switch for that. Throw the switch, push the panic button, a light comes on. To test on through, you call them right from the transceiver and tell them you want a hot test to the cameras and back to the stations.
Suppose the test shows that we aren't getting through. Can you spot what's wrong?
Maybe, Larry said doubtfully. If it was just a loose connection. But Duke is the electron pusher. I'm more the intellectual type.
I know, son. I'm not bright about practical matters either. Well, do the best you can.
Anything else, Jubal?
If you see the man who invented the wheel, send him up. Meddler.
Jubal considered the possibility that Duke had sabotaged the panic button, but rejected the thought. He allowed himself to wonder what had really happened in his garden and how the lad had done it from 10 feet underwater. He had no doubt that Mike had been behind those impossible shenanigans. What he had seen the day before in this very room was just as intellectually stupefying. But the emotional impact was not.